You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
The decline and fall of the Roman Empire has been a story that has fascinated the Western countries and culture for centuries. There is plenty of drama and intrigue in the political turmoil within the empire that threatened its collapse. But what are the wars on the periphery? And I don't mean just the way they've been often glossed over or explained as pressures upon certain emperors, or one or two discussions about a battle here or there. In this episode, our first going so far back in history, we will focus on one such war on the periphery. G'day listeners, it's your host Mick, and welcome back to the Dead Prussian Podcast. Thank you very much for all the iTunes support, the reviews, the donations as well have helped, and thank you for your comments on the new format for the non-interview episodes. I will continue to tweak that format, but aim to provide you a shorter episode that will give you a quick look at a book, film, or any other form of information transmission about war and warfare that I think you could pick up and have a look at. Now, to today's topic, let's talk about Rome. My guest today is Major General Retired John S. Harrell. His active military service began in 1975 when he was commissioned as an infantry second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps. He transferred to the California Army National Guard in 1980, and since his commissioning, he's held many positions of responsibility, including Commander Task Force 185 ARMA in the 1992 Los Angeles riots. For those listeners of us old enough to remember those, he was the Commanding General 40th Infantry Division and Commanding General for Task Force Falcon Multinational Brigade East, Kosovo, and Army Forces Commander, Kosovo, Macedonia, and Albania. John was the Commanding General of the California National Guard from June 2009 to April 2011. He retired from the California Attorney General's office after 30 years rising from a law clerk to Deputy Attorney General 4. That's right, not just a distinguished military career, but quite a distinguished law career as well. He served in the Criminal, Correctional, and Torts Condemnation and Civil Rights Division. Now that's a mouthful. I don't actually know what all that means, but I don't have to because hopefully it won't come up too often that my expertise in law is required in this episode. He's got a Bachelor of Arts and a Master of Arts as well in History and a Juris Doctorate of Law. And if you don't know what a JD is, I do, and I'm not going to tell you. Most importantly, he's the author of The Nisibis War, The Defense of the Roman East, AD 337 to 363. John, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks, Mix. Thanks for having me. Until you contacted me, I was not aware of your podcast, but since your initial contact, I have listened to a number of your presentations, and they're all first rate. I wish I knew about them earlier. Now I have to catch up with the 20-some-odd casts that you've got online. I especially like the Black War podcast, which was a fight that I was not familiar with. I'm a mixed-blood First Nation Cherokee, and First Nation is now the political term for Indian, and I've always been interested in the early colonial wars on the settlement of America and other colonial areas. America and Australia have a very similar founding. The Carolina colonies, which are today the states of North and South Carolina, were penal colonies, and they were filled with indentured servants and convicted criminals. In Australia, the ratio of the men to women was high, but once free, a former inmate or indentured servant drifted to the frontier, often marrying into one of the five civilized tribes, which the Cherokee are one of. This personal family history is what made the Black War so interesting, to see that Australia and America had very similar beginnings but developed along different paths due to the environment and the opposition that the colonists found.
Well, John, thank you very much for the compliment. They're always welcome here on the show. And what's great is that you've actually managed to get something out of my show, which is good. But also, the particular episode you mentioned obviously has a bit of a personal connection to myself, having grown up in the areas of the Black War, obviously a few years later. But what I do appreciate is that you've done your research on me, so I'll try and be on my game. Now, you've written a book about the Nisibis Wall, which was part of the defence of the Eastern Roman Empire. It's a reasonably new label for this particular conflict in time. However, we'll get to that after you tell myself and the listeners a little bit about how you got interested in Roman history, and particularly this war.
Yeah, I'd be happy to tell you about that. When I was a kid, growing up in the 50s and the 60s, I had a normal working class life, public school, Boy Scouts, hunting and fishing. And for the British listeners, a public school in the United States is the free school that most Americans attend. Well, private school is the high tuition schools that are paid by the family. My dad was a firefighter and scoutmaster, and ever since I can remember, I loved ancient history. A lot of that had to do with in the 60s, there were a lot of big budget, high production, ancient movies like Antony and Cleopatra, Ben-Hur, The Robe, things like that. But there was also a lot of sword and sandal, low-budget movies from Italy that played on Saturday mornings with the old Westerns that I used to watch as a kid. Now, while these sword and sandal movies, you know, basically gave you a novel view of history, and they were probably not very accurate, they did get me hooked on ancient history. And around 8 years old, I found a comic book on Caesar's war commentaries. And then when I reached the age of 10, I found in an old bookstore a copy of Caesar's war commentaries that I picked up for like 25 cents in those days. And then when I was 12, my sister gave me an unabridged English translation of Plutarch's Lives. So between those two books and those old Italian sword and sandal movies, that really kind of locked me into studying ancient history. After I had a family tragedy, I spent my teenage years with an uncle and his family. And in those days, the Vietnam War was going on, and I always wanted a military career, basically from studying Caesar's commentaries and Plutarch's Lives. And when I was old enough, I walked into the Marine recruiter's office and aced the test, and basically became a Marine officer candidate and a reserve enlisted Marine. And they said, get yourself in college and get yourself a degree. Well, in California now and 40 years ago, college is almost free compared to most of the rest of the world. So I completed my first 2 years at a community college and my last 2 years at a California State University in Northridge, and I was commissioned a Marine second lieutenant in 75. However, it was college that took my hobby of reading ancient history into actually the study of ancient history. And then my travels over the years have basically just reinforced it. After my 5 years on active duty, I got married, transferred to the Army National Guard in 1980, entered law school on the GI Bill, and my wife saw how much fun I was having in the Guard, so she joined the Guard also. She was a state transportation lawyer when we got married, so she got a direct commission as an Army lawyer, didn't have to go through officer candidate school and, run 100 miles a day. But eventually, after 28 years as a Deputy Attorney General and 32 years in the California Guard, I retired and I went back and finished my master's degree in basically late antiquity. When I got to the university, I was intending to study the settlement of the Pacific in the 18th and 19th century, but I ran into a guy named Frank Vitai, who turned out to be my faculty advisor, and he guided me into late antiquity. He knew, which I didn't at the time, that late antiquity is not really well covered when you talk about military studies on campaigns. Majority of people have a tendency to study Caesar and his time. And so even though late antiquity has a lot of sources available, it's kind of overlooked. And when we talk about late antiquity, we're talking about Constantine the Great until the rise of Islam. That period is full of great sources, original sources, eyewitnesses, accounts, but very few people address that area in the military side. It's normally on the religious side, because it's also the time of the rise of Christianity and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But during this same time, we traveled, my wife and family, we traveled all over the world. This is the United Kingdom, Italy, Greece, Turkey. I dragged my wife and son over probably every ancient ruined fort and Roman ruin in those countries. So it was one of those things, once it bit you, I couldn't give it up.
It's great to see late antiquity covered in more detail other than just the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. So I guess we should start off with a bit of an overview of the Nisibis War, because most of our listeners wouldn't know too much. As you said, late antiquity, the military side's not covered off, although if there are any podcast listeners out there, they might have listened to the history of Rome and also the Byzantine history out there. They're two great shows as well. But who was the war between, and what was it fought over?
Well, war was between Rome and Sassanid Persia. And I'd like to go over just a little bit of the overview of the book, and then I'll go into the more details of it.
Yeah.
Because one of the reviewers of the book mentioned that the Nisibis War, that's in the discuss of the defense of the Roman East, is actually only part of the book, since the label doesn't cover the breadth of the book itself. But the book was entitled about the defense of the Roman East, and deep analysis of Julian, his campaign and his defeat in AD 363. But it also covers the civil war between Constantius II and Magentius and the climactic battle of Mursa, and the detailed analysis and rise of Julian the Apostate, his victory at Strasbourg, and eventually his defeat in the East.
Yeah.
And the reason those are added into the defense of the East is, just like any other conflict, understanding the factors that are involved with why it was fought in a certain way, a lot of times is more than just looking at that initial region, but you got to look at the whole, in this case, Roman Empire, to understand why Constantius II was forced to make certain decisions. But the background of the war starts in 3rd century or the 200s, which was Rome's crisis, when Rome actually almost fell apart. They had 60-some-odd emperors in a relatively short time, of which only four died in bed. And that was the time that the Sassanid Persians overthrew the Parthian ruling house and took over the Parthian Empire. The Persians were much more aggressive than the Parthians, and between the years 240 and 298, the Persians started a series of wars with Rome or its client state, Palmyra. And it wasn't until at the end of this period that Diocletian finally got the upper hand on the Persians and decisively defeated them. And as part of that peace treaty, the city of Nisibis was ceded to the Romans. The Roman border was shifted from the Euphrates River to the Tigris River. And Rome took five regions of Persia on the east side of the Tigris River. Now, where is Nisibis? Well, if you look at a modern map, it's on the border between Turkey and Syria. And in those days, in the ancient days, that was a terminus of the Silk Road. So all the trading routes coming from Asia basically ended in Nisibis. And this would have been the province of Mesopotamia, which was a very fertile area just north of the Iraqi desert. And so it was a very, very valuable area for the Roman East or the Persian West. The five trans-Tigris regions were never incorporated into a province, but Roman forts and garrisons were installed in there, and it was kind of like the northwest frontier of India in the British colonial days there, where it was kind of unincorporated. It was policed by tribesmen under British rule, so in this case it'd be policed by Romans with tribesmen and Arabs, desert dwellers.
Yeah.
the Persians obviously wanted this region back, but after Diocletian's treaty, they had a series of weak rulers until King Shapur II was born in about 3009. But because he was a minor, he really couldn't take the Syrian field level, and his advisors basically did try just to keep the empire together until he reached the age of 16. When he hit 16, he led his army, and he first defeated the Arabs at the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Arabia. And by 333, he was now ready to take on the Romans. Now, the Romans under Diocletian and Constantine the Great had reformed the Roman army and built a fortified zone in what is now northern Iraq and Syria. Basically, Nisibis was in the center of five fortified cities, and there was no way to attack Antioch or Syria without going through Nisibis and overcoming these fortified cities. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, Constantine, when King Shapur started fighting the Arabs, Constantine the Great got nervous about the Persians, and he decided to invade Persia and replace King Shapur with a puppet. But he died in 333 just as he was getting ready to invade. And based on his death, it caused a crisis in the Roman Empire, and his three sons then took over the empire.
Yeah.
Constantius II took over the west, the east. Constantine II took the west, and then Constantius took the center. And at that time, the court army of King the Great had 100,000 men, which was basically the offensive power of the entire Roman army, the Roman Empire. But when Constantine the Great died, that army was divided in amongst his three sons. So the primary player in the book or this story, Constantine II, basically only had about 30,000 soldiers with which he could do offensive operations against the Persians. And now when Constantine II died, Shapur took advantage of the confusion and started the war by attacking the city and besieging the city of Nisibis in 337. Now, I named the war the Nisibis War because, as you heard from the little narration, there was a lot of fighting going on between the Persians and the Romans, and there was basically five separate wars, not skirmishes, between the founding of the Persian Empire and the Nisibis War, and I got tired of referring to it as the Fifth Persian-Roman War. So I named the war the Nisibis War, became the name of the book, primarily because that was King Shapur's objective.
Okay, so it sounds like quite an interesting period for the Romans and the rising Persians at the time. You stated the size of the army initially, being 100,000 men, then split down upon the emperor's death and division amongst his sons. What sort of tactics were used by either side, and I suppose also strategies employed by the generals in order to try and hold some of this territory?
Well, the war lasted from 337 to 363, so almost 25 years. Now, the traditional way of the Romans doing battle was basically take the offensive, march into the opponent's territory, go directly for the capital, besiege it. If the opponent of the Romans had a field army to throw in their way, they would try to stop the Romans, of course. The Romans would defeat the field army and besiege the city. So it was a great frontal attack confrontation. It was the Roman way of battle, and that basically served them from the war with the Carthaginians to Constantine the Great. So that was the traditional way. But now, when Constantius II only had 30,000 men that he could use on the offensive, he had to look at things a little different. Now, the Emperor Constantius adopted a defensive strategy, what we would call today a mobile defense strategy, based upon the small frontier Limitate forces, and Limitate just means the border army, border soldiers, that would man the fortifications and the cities, do all the patrolling along the border. And they were backed up by his court army, or the field army of the east, so that as the Persians would attack into the zone, they would have to confront with a fortress, and then Constantius II could decide whether to confront the Persian invaders in a field battle or wait until they got exhausted by banging their head against these fortified cities. Now, this method was very successful, and it checked the Persian assault for 24 years. He got the Emperor Constantius II got a lot of criticism because he wasn't doing the old-fashioned Roman, as we would say, hey, diddle-diddle, up the middle and go straight for the capital and defeat him in the field. But with only 30,000 men in his field army, he really didn't have the manpower to go head-to-head with the main Persian army, which could have been anything between 40,000 to 60,000 men, given what time of the year that they were in the field. So basically, you know, the question is, well, why didn't he ask help and have them send reinforcements? Well, like any other family, and now that they're all emperors, there was a lot of sibling rivalry between the three of them. And on top of that, there was some religious controversy, Constantius II being an Arian Christian and the others being Catholics. So there was a lot of friction in that. So as a result, there's no history between 337 and 350 of any reinforcements coming from his brothers to help him out fighting the Persians.
Really?
So he was on his own. So he had to adjust his tactics and strategy based on a field army of 30,000 men. Now, during this period, Shapur assaulted Nisibis three times, in 337, 345, and 350. And in each of those invasions, Constantius II held his army in reserve and allowed the Persians basically to expend all their strength in a costly sieges, all of which failed against the main city. During this time, there was probably two maybe huge field battles. Both of them became bloody draws, which neither side could really afford. And normally after these field battles, there was a couple years before the Persians attempt to invade again. But there wasn't a time of peace because the border armies of both sides were fighting constantly, skirmishes, raids, plundering on both sides of the Tigris River. In 350, a major event happened both in Persia and in Rome. In the Persians' case, the White Huns attacked in what would be today in the vicinity of Afghanistan, which is the Bactrian area. And so King Shapur had to stop his campaigns against Rome and shift his royal army to his eastern border. Constantius II, at the same time, had a usurper kill his one of his brothers, and he had to take his field army and go conquer the usurper. And this was basically both royal armies were out of the fight on the east for about 8 years, with Constantius II fighting a civil war, and then he had problems with the tribes along the Rhine and the Danube. And the Persians, however, found a solution. They made peace with the nomads and then hired them as mercenaries. So they were ready to resume the war east 2 years earlier than, of course, the Romans were. The other thing that happened is Shapur had 8 years of campaigning under his belt now when he was a mature general. And he was probably during that 8 years, he was thinking about his problem in the West. And he eventually came up with the solution that the key to taking Nisibis was not making a direct assault in the Roman way, but to take the fortified cities that surrounded it and then establish a forward base of operation a few days from Nisibis. Pretty much all of the sieges came. He ran out of supplies. Now with a forward base, he could mass supplies during the year up forward and then a short supply line to defend so that he could successfully besiege the city. Now for this last part of the campaign, we're lucky we have a historian that was actually on scene, Arminius. He was a historian. He was a staff officer on the staffs for pretty much all the fights between 358 and 363. He's an eyewitness. The interesting thing, he only puts himself in the story once during the 359 campaign and the siege of Amida. but he never portrays himself as a hero, which you would think he would do if he's always a staff officer advising generals and counts and dukes. But he gives you an eyewitness account of how the Persians and the Romans fought. But he basically comes in, he describes how Constantius was engaged in the west, and Shapur's army stormed the fortress of Singara, and that's the southern end of the, basically the agricultural belt of Mesopotamia, but it guarded the southern approach to Nespis. So Shapur storms Singara, and then he marches across the Mesopotamian Valley and attacks the city of Amida, which is on north of the Nespis. He storms it also and takes it, and Arminius gives us great details about the tactics and used by the defending Romans and by the Persians. Then he pulls back to Persia, and then in 360, he attacks again, takes Singara again, and then he countermarches and takes a town called Bezabadi, and it sits on the Tigris.
So basically, he turned Bezabadi into a logistics base. And up until this time, you notice that Constantius II, I never mentioned him because he was engaged in the West. But at the end of the campaign season in 360, after Bezabadi was taken, he finally attacks, gets his army back into the region, and he tries to recapture the city before winter and fails. So now the Constantius II and his field army are sitting in Mesopotamia with the Tigris in between him and the Persian army. During the campaign season of 361, both the Persians and the Romans just eyed each other across the river. Constantius II made no attempt to take the town, but it was at that time that Julian the Apostate in Gaul had been declared emperor. So Constantius countermarched towards Europe, but he died before he engaged Julian, which prevented another civil war. Now, the change of administration made a big difference. Everyone up until this time had been basically criticizing Constantius II for not using the traditional Roman strategy. He used the mobile defense strategy. And so when Julian took over emperor, along with many different trying to turn back Christianity, which he's most famous for, he decided to mass the entire 100,000-man field army into Persia and do an invasion of Persia. And in the book, I go into great detail on Julian, on how he became a good general and how he rose to power. But for this cast, I'll just cover what he does on his way to Ctesiphon, the Persian capital. He basically takes his 100,000 men, divides it into two armies, one to stay up in Mesopotamia and Nespis area as a defensive force, and the second was to march down the Euphrates River and then cross over to the Tigris to take Ctesiphon. What happens is he runs in, the Persian army is still up in the Persian plateau of Iran, so the Seren, who is like the number two guy in the Persian Empire, has 5,000 men as a covering force waiting for the Persians in the snow in the passes to melt so they can come into the Tigris Valley. So he fights a series of running skirmishes with the Roman army as they advance down the Euphrates. But basically his Persians and Arab cavalry are superior to the Roman cavalry, and all the skirmishes, they basically win. So as a result, what happens, the Roman security screen basically stops functioning. Every time they ride out, they get defeated by this 5,000-man Persian cavalry force. And so Julian's 60,000 men that he's taking down the river are now basically marching blind. They're too strong for the Seren to actually have an open field battle with, but he basically prevents them from getting their security screen out. And the Romans are basically moving blind down the Euphrates River, and then eventually over to Ctesiphon. Basically, on this fight, the Persian Julian crosses the Tigris, has a battle outside of Ctesiphon, basically has a chance to capture the city, and through the basically fog of war, doesn't get enough men at the right place at the right time to get through the gate. So shortly after that battle, the Persian army appears and the Romans start having logistics problems. That is probably the biggest issue that is involved in both the war, and I go over in detail, is logistics is dictating the tactics and the strategies that both sides are using. Now, when Julian realized that he couldn't take the city and he had to retreat, he started to retreat up the Tigris River, and now the Royal Persian Army had appeared. And the King Shapur decided, instead of making a big big battle where they're going to let winning or losing be the basically a cast of the dice, he decides to fight a series of running battles as the Roman army retreats. And the Roman army at this time is blind. As I told before, on the way down, when there was only 5,000 Persian cavalry fighting the security screen, they basically won all the battles. The Roman cavalry was afraid to go out and confront the Persian cavalry. Now when they're marching north on the Tigris, basically the only thing they could secure was basically bow shot around the square of the Roman army as it marched north. The Persian cavalry had pretty much defeated their reconnaissance effort, defeated their cavalry security screen, and it's basically a square of infantry marching north along the river, and the cavalry often being in the center of the square. Now, one of the tactics that the Persians used, now that they had the Romans blind, is they basically used the ambush technique. So every evening, the Romans would camp. In the morning, they would form their square. They'd start marching north. The Persians would lay in ambush, but the interesting thing is the Persians were laying in ambush with cavalry and elephants. So if you can envision marching across the desert, a rolling terrain, and elephant is a pretty big animal to conceal, but they have elephants hiding in draws with cavalry and support, and the Romans don't detect them until they charge out of the draws and hit the infantry square. Now, most historians, question the value of elephants in pre-gunfight, gunpowder battles, primarily because of the Battle of Zama, where the untrained Carthaginian war elephants ran amok, ran back into their own side, and caused more damage to the Carthaginians. But well-trained war elephants in India were used as decisive units up to the gunpowder period. And the Sasanian Persian elephants were Indian war elephants, and they were well-trained. They were all trained to work with cavalry, and they were well-trained to fight in sieges, and they were well-trained to fight in open battles. So with the properly trained war elephants that attacked the Romans, on the day that Julian died, an elephant attack had basically caved in one side of the square. And in the confusion of the melee, of the elephant attack, Julian was killed or assassinated, depends on which version you take. A few days later, the elephants, the Romans were literally coming out of their camp at sunup to form the square, and the elephants made a basically dawn attack, hit one side of the square, and would have broken the square, except for the two legions, Hercules and Jovian, which were pushed back by the elephants to the baggage train and then used the baggage train as a defensive bulwark to be able to defeat the elephants. But basically, the elephants were a major part of Persian war, the Persian war effort, from basically this period till the end of the Persian Empire when Islam overran the Persian Empire. So we're not talking about the untrained war elephants of the Carthaginians. We're talking about very well-trained elephants that would be more familiar with the Indian armies, even in the Middle Ages. But it was the tactical employment of elephants that basically brought the Roman army to the brink of destruction, pinned them against the river, and basically allowed the peace treaty, which basically stayed in effect up until for about 150 years and secured that frontier.
It's a long peace treaty, but I guess they do say that elephants have a long memory. Maybe the memory of elephants in this case was a little bit longer amongst the Romans. Now, you talked about Shapur, Constantius II, and Julian the Apostate. Were these the main key personalities in the war? And you know, how did each of their personalities, I suppose, affect the outcome?
Yeah, the basic Shapur II basically steals the show. When I wrote the book, I didn't expect him to come out as such a flowing, chivalrous king and capable military leader. But the more I studied it, the more I found that he was basically the key to this whole period. On the Roman side, Constantius II often is overlooked and underrated. He actually, you know, came up with the strategy. It was based on the defensive strategy of his father, Constantine the Great. But when he only had 30,000 men, he couldn't revert to the Roman traditional tactics and the strategy. He had to actually employ the strategy that his father developed, even though it was non-Roman. He got a lot of criticism for it. But there were a lot of major players that I address in the book. Is Julian the Apostate. Most people know him because of his attempt to turn the empire back to paganism, but he was actually a capable administrator and a decent general. Then there's also Augusta Constantina, which is Constantius II's sister, who he married to his nephew Caesar Gallus, who ruled the East while he was out fighting the civil war against Magentius. So there was a number of key major players that influenced the effects in the East. But what I also like to try to do is, you know, let's face it, we give credit to the emperor and kings and queens for a lot of things that their ministers or their generals, colonels, or even sergeants or centurions actually did. So in the book, I try to give as much details and background of the minor players that really are left out of the major historians, like two of the key people are the traitors, Antonius and Cargagius, who basically were giving King Shapur intelligence information about the Roman East. There was two captadoctors, which are drill instructors of legions that led a raid into the Persian besiegers of Emedia. Count Aurelius, who I suspect commanded a small Trans-Tigris field force of local tribesmen fighting the Persians all through the 25 years of the war. And we got Count Victor, who was really the Marshal Ney of the period, Count Sebastian, who was the Roman army's soldier. So there, you know, I tried to go into as much as we can based on the records of the average soldier, statesman, politician, traitor, that actually had an impact on the outcome of the war that, of course, the king and the emperors got the credit for.
It's something that's not often seen with histories. They do, as you said, stick to the emperors. It's actually great to see a staff officer getting mentioned every now and then. And of course, you know, the namesake of this show is quite often lauded as the epitome of a staff officer. But staff officers back then used to do a bit more of the blood and guts work as well, from what we know. Now, John, we do have to wrap up at some stage, so. One thing I found interesting about this war in particular is that this is raging in the East, the Roman Empire, while there's a massive amount of political and religious turmoil occurring in the rest of the empire that some of the listeners would be aware about and some of the others wouldn't be. But that was also quite tumultuous, I suppose, for the empire as well. And often these wars are glossed over, and if you don't look into it and you don't find these wars, you may not learn the lessons. It's quite interesting also knowing that territory that's currently being fought over now was being fought over a while ago by not too dissimilar forces. However, we have to get to the final question because it is the price for coming on the show. Now, our mission is to discuss war and warfare, to frame the debate and join the conversation and make it as broad as possible. So each guest gets to finish a sentence. Now, I don't think I've had a lawyer on the show yet, so this could be asking for trouble asking a lawyer for definitions. But I ask you to finish the sentence, war is.
Well, being a lawyer, I've got two. One as being a senior officer and one from being the people in the trenches. As a senior officer, basically war is foreign policy by other means, as Clausewitz told us. but to a Joe or a Jane in the trenches who may have joined the army for adventure, patriotism, or economic advantage, but they've lost, entered combat, lost close friends, they soon discover war is hell on earth.
That's two, war is hell on earth, which is good. It's very, very Sherman-esque. And there's also the high-level classics one, which is always a favorite of our guests on the show. John, thank you very much for coming on the show, taking time out of your very, very busy retired lifestyle. It's great to have a different branch of history come on the show and have some color and depth brought into the discussion that we've got, being the first of any ancient or antiquity level discussions that we've had, and it's only taken us into the 30s of our episodes to get there. Readers, I do encourage you to go out. You can find John's book, The Nisibis War, on Amazon. Give it a read if you're interested in understanding this conflict in an area that a lot of militaries, particularly Western militaries, are involved in at the moment. Maybe some of the lessons of history could be learned to educate some of the decisions of the future. John, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Mick.
And listeners, as always, I'll stick out the tin and say there are many ways to support the show on social media, through the donations, or on the iTunes reviews and subscriptions. Remember, send us a review. Feel free to give us 5 stars, 3 stars, 4 stars. If you're going to give us 2 stars, well, that's okay. You can probably just send me some hate mail instead, and that way it won't show up in a public forum. And for those people that want to get us up on the iTunes What's Hot, I need subscriptions. More people subscribing for free on iTunes will get the show higher in iTunes esteem. But until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons attribution license. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.